retention rates between the two sides. So the biggest driver of this change in COVID-19 prevalence and severity is the newest subvariant called XBB.1.5. If you're following the COVID news, you might have seen that some people have termed it the Kraken variant. That is not a medical term. We don't use that, but I wanted to reference it in case you're wondering, because it gives you more level of concern that I think is entirely appropriate. But what we've seen so far from XBB.1 is that it is more infectious, more immune evasive, particularly for prior infection. And in those who are not up to date on their vaccines, we're seeing early indications of increased severity as well. And so we think that's what's driving what's going on the East Coast right now. Interestingly, though, this subvariant is actually very similar to BA.5, which is in the bivalent vaccine. And so we're seeing very good coverage from the bivalent against this newest subvariant. So what we saw on the East Coast is that within a couple weeks of its arrival, it just rapidly overtook all of the other variants. On the West Coast, we've had it for over a month, and it's only about 8% of the variants that we're seeing. And we think the primary driver of that is that we're more vaccinated. The nation as a whole is about 15% vaccinated with bivalent. Compare that to Jefferson County, where we're 47% vaccinated with the bivalent. And so that really does appear to be driving a very different picture than what we're hearing in the rest of the country. Now, it's no guarantee. It's possible that we could see a surge here too, much like what we've seen on the East Coast. But so far, it's not shaking out that way. And the biggest protection we have against that is to be up to date on your boosters. So if you haven't gotten your bivalent yet, now is a really good time to get it, because it's very good protection against the subvariant that's starting to circulate widely in the country as a whole. In Jefferson County right now, we have diagnosed 43 cases in the last week, which puts us at a case rate of 246. Our case ascertainment rate is a little better than last week at 1 in 10. So you can estimate that there's about 430 people who have COVID in the last week, and our case rate is over 2,000. So still there's a lot circulating, but it's flat or actually decreasing from where we were last week. And thankfully, we're not seeing a significant rise in severe disease. There's only one person hospitalized for COVID-19 in our community right now, for a total of 176. And thankfully, we have no new deaths to announce today. On the other virus watch area, we are seeing significant and sustained decreases in flu and RSV activity in our region as well, thankfully. RSV is now 8% positive. When people get tested for RSV, only about 8% of them actually have it. And for flu, it's 9% test positivity, and only about 2% of ED visits in our region right now are for influenza-like illnesses. So it's really coming down sharply, and we're really hopeful that we're going to actually see that sustained, because we haven't seen a post-holiday bump in our region. We unfortunately do have one piece of bad news to share today, which is that we did lose one of our residents to influenza. We have one death to announce today. This was a gentleman in his 70s. He had underlying conditions and he was not vaccinated. It's a painful reminder that the most important thing we can do to reduce severe disease and transmission of the flu in our community is to get vaccinated. So if you haven't yet, there's still time. I still recommend you go out and get that. Definitely, I recommend going out and getting your bivalent if you haven't already, and masking when we're in crowded indoor spaces continues to be important. I don't think it will be forever. I do think actually one of our questions on KPTZ was about that, of why do we think that it's going to get better? I do think COVID-19 is starting to move into a more seasonal pattern, much like flu and RSV, even with the subvariants, because so many of us have had it over the course of this winter. It's likely that we're going to see it move into more of a seasonal pattern. So we'll see less transmission as we move into the spring, because so many people got it in the last couple of months, and the normal changes in our behavior when we get into the warmer months. Now, there are never any guarantees when it comes to COVID-19. It can always surprise us, but I am hopeful that we're likely to see more of a seasonal pattern. The best thing we can do to make that happen is to make sure we're up to date on all our vaccines, and to continue to wear masks through the winter season. And then we'll keep monitoring things as we move into the spring, and hopefully we'll see better days when we get there. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the commissioners.
Any questions for Dr. Berry today?
I don't
I have one. Hi, Dr. Berry.
Hi.
I'm curious, and I feel like my family is moving a little bit back in time to stricter protocols with my husband in an aggressive chemotherapy regimen. Can you tell me how effective is masking right now with current subvariants, and especially the kind of one-sided masking? You know, we're trying to decide how, like, obviously we can mask consistently, but, you know, when we're going to places where other people aren't masked, how much risk is there still with kind of the one-sided masking for protection?
Sure. So when you're talking about kind of one-sided protection-based masking, where everyone else around you is unmasked, really, especially when you're dealing with someone who's very high risk, people undergoing chemotherapy are some of the highest risk. You really do want your best possible mask that they can tolerate. So if they can tolerate an N95, that is highly effective. And still, even for current variants, you're seeing upward of 95% efficacy for preventing getting the virus, as long as it fits you well and you wear it well. And so for men, that means if you're wearing an N95, you actually can't have a beard. I see Commissioner Brotherton knows this detail. So it doesn't work as well if there's hair holding it off from your face. It really should have a tight seal around your mouth. If your KN95s work quite well as well, you're talking upwards of 90% protection. And they are generally much more comfortable for many folks. The trick with your KN95 is that you should see when you're breathing heavily, like say you're climbing stairs, that you should see it bend in. And if it's doing that, you have a good seal. So for myself, for my face, a KN95 fits well. For other folks, you might feel kind of a pull on your ears, and a KF94 might be a better match. Same thing, you want to see it bend in when you're breathing in deeply. If you have that, you have a good seal and you're pretty well protected. You always want to layer your prevention. So for instance, if you're having people over to your house and, you know, one member of your family is very high risk and going to be in an N95, it's still good to, you know, talk to everybody else who's coming, make sure they're not sick, make sure that, you know, they haven't been doing very high risk things. You know, they just went to a large indoor concert 4 days ago. It might be worth having them get tested before they come in, those kind of things. But it's a matter of minimizing risk as much as you can while living your life the best you can. You know, especially when you're dealing with very difficult diagnoses, it's important to see humans and have that kind of closeness, but to do it as safely as you can. And I think it is important to acknowledge that there are individuals in our community that will need to have higher levels of protection and have needed to throughout this process. We have people who are on immunosuppressants who often feel kind of left behind as we talk about the days when there might be less masking. And so I think we should all try to keep that in mind. There will be people who will likely be in large-scale masks, more intense masks, long after the rest of us take them off. And I think being thoughtful about that, being gracious, and offering to put on a mask when you see someone, if you see someone in an N95 in a store, it's probably a reason for that. And thinking about ways that we can support them, make them more comfortable, and reduce their risk by potentially masking up when they're around, that can all go a long way.
Thank you.
Can I follow up on that real quick? I'm curious if, you know, as we, you know, move into this new landscape, and it kind of resonated with me, you know, if you see someone in an N95 in a store, there's a reason they're wearing it. And I think just to build that empathy muscle, do you know what percentage of our population, you know, roughly should be wearing an N95 that, you know, are immunosuppressed or are really at risk? And if they're really thinking about the long-term health, should be wearing one.
Yeah, I think statewide, the estimate was that we're looking at about 7% of the population is on serious enough immunosuppressants that they're likely going to need that long term. In Jefferson County, because of the age of our population, it's likely higher. So roughly probably about 15% of our population is going to need kind of higher level protection. And that's just for immunosuppression. People on chemo, people on immunosuppressants. There's other folks, you know, people who are over 65 and have, you know, had multiple heart attacks, you know, things that put them at high risk of severe COVID, that will also need that as well. So there's probably at least 1 in 5 of us is going to need significant protection going forward. And it's important to keep them in mind and support them as we move through all this. And remember, you can't always tell. You know, there are young people who are facing cancer diagnoses who you might not be able to see it when you see them. So have that compassion and do what you can all the way through to mitigate risk. You know, don't go places when you're sick. It's really important to the extent that you can. If you're at all wondering if you're sick, putting a mask on when you're going out, all those kind of things still make a big difference as we move into this next phase.
Well, and just a shout out that for each of those 1 in 5, there is probably a caregiver that is needing to be extremely cautious too. Mm-hmm. So you can hopefully almost double that as well.
Right. Yeah, hopefully we have support people for these individuals. So,
are we?
One other thing I wanted to add there is that is important. Is if you have someone in your house that you're taking care of who's particularly high risk, the more protective steps you can make in your life, the safer they'll be. Which includes also important to remember newborn infants. So kids under 6 months don't have functioning immune systems. And so doing everything we can to protect them, to minimize our risk, and to, when we have visitors, because that's a high visitor time, to make sure that people are well and masked when they're visiting newborn kids.
I was just going to say, I think we're all going to feel grateful for the enhanced outdoor entertaining areas that we created over the
last.
I know Kate did. Before I was elected a commissioner, I saw her and we had a Christmas party there a couple of years ago. But I think, you know, it's one of the silver linings of COVID is spending more time outside with the people we love. So
learning how to better protect them.
Right.
Yeah, always needed. Yep.
Absolutely. Well, we didn't have a ton of questions today, but a couple were about data. So one was asking, so last week we reported 38 positive cases, but a case ascertainment rate of 1 in 15. And they said, does that mean 570 people currently have active COVID in Jefferson County? And the answer is yes. That's our estimate, is that you really need to take whatever number of cases we report that week and multiply it by the case ascertainment rate. There was also a suggestion that that our local media report that case ascertainment rate and help people figure out how to apply it. And we can certainly work on some more messaging on that on our end, but it is really important. The numbers we report are a tiny fraction of the amount that are out there. We're catching a little bit more now. It's 1 in 10 this week, but you still wanna take our number of cases and our case rate and multiply it by 10. And that's how much is circulating at this moment.
Can I follow up on that real quick, Dr. Berry?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious with your earlier report about the troubling trend on the East Coast versus the West Coast, and with the, you know, the case ascertainment rate that we have, are we seeing higher rates over there? Or are we seeing higher rates of serious disease?
I mean, we have similar case ascertainment challenges across the country. So there's no reason to think that the East Coast is finding more cases than we are. But one of the key differences is we're seeing significant rises in severe disease. And so you're not going to miss those. I have colleagues, because I trained on the East Coast, that are working in East Coast hospitals, and they're starting to see the hospitals getting overrun with COVID patients again, which is thankfully not something we're seeing out here.
And I guess I would imagine that if that happened locally, we would kind of buckle down on the testing and reporting. So your case ascertainment rate, I would guess, would go down as serious disease goes up. So I guess that's the balance I was trying to understand a little deeper.
Yeah, the case ascertainment rate, part of how we model that is based on severity of disease. So if you're seeing a ton of hospitalizations and your case rate hasn't changed at all, unless you're seeing a more severe variant, which could potentially be what's going on, generally that means you're just missing a ton of them. The other thing that we do have is our wastewater surveillance. We have that in Port Townsend. And thankfully, that's actually also downtrending. So the wastewater doesn't lie. And so we do think we're actually seeing our case rates go down here, which is a very different behavior.
Great, thank you.
And then there were just, I think that was actually most of it. Oh yeah, that's the last question was, what are we going to do for February as far as KPTC and the BOCC? And I'm open to our commissioners' preferences on that. I lean towards sticking with twice a month through February because it's still the winter and weird things can happen, but potentially moving back to monthly after that.
Thoughts?
I think twice a month sounds good. We see a bump in participation on Zoom, at least on the weeks that you are with us. So I think people are still tuning in for it. I support that.
Yep, I agree. February 1st and 3rd Mondays in February, and have another discussion at the end of February.
That sounds great.
Thanks, Dr. Berry.
Thank you.
Can I ask, we're not done yet.
No. I was just thanking her for her time. We keep messing with her time.
I know the in meeting motion.
No ending.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about China. You know, I'm reading really troubling articles about, you know, the results of the zero COVID policy, and then sort of just a 180 degree about face, it seems like, and wondering what your analysis is of that, what they're doing now and what they should be doing, are going to be doing.
Yeah, I definitely have been hearing some concern about that as well. One of the more common concerns I hear in the United States is, you know, what does this mean for us? Are we going to get new weird variants out of China? And likely no. A lot of what is driving what's going on in China is they did have a zero COVID policy for so long. And so the vast majority of their country hasn't had COVID. It's a very different situation than what we've seen here. And unfortunately, they haven't had the level of vaccination and booster campaign that we've had. And that's, I think, and they've been using different vaccines. So we're seeing less effective vaccines, far less effective booster campaign, very little population immunity, and now no controls at all. And that's kind of the opposite of what you would recommend. I don't think it, you know, foretells anything that we're going to see here, because we're just in such very different situations. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that you would see a more severe variant come out of that, but you are likely to see a highly transmissible one. And that's consistent with what we're already seeing. It's unfortunate, though. It's going to lead to far more suffering than it needs to. And I think it is a good reminder that when we pull back on medications, doing so in a thoughtful manner, a gradual manner, is much safer. And you want to make sure that your population is well protected before you do so, and that people have had the opportunity to access the vaccines that are their best protection against severe disease. So very different situation there than here, but it's sad to see that much suffering happening.
Great. And then MPV, totally gone?
Probably not entirely gone, but we're certainly not seeing any significant transmission. We actually have started in Washington doing wastewater surveillance for MPV because it's a rare disease. So it's a good one for wastewater. And we're not even seeing it in the wastewater. We're not testing in Port Townsend, but they have started pilot testing in King County and not even seeing it there. So very successful mitigation campaign, the vaccination campaign there, as well as really good messaging and kind of behavior discussion within the most affected community, I think has really, really done an excellent job at dramatically decreasing transmission of MPV. I don't think we can say that we've eradicated it. We don't have enough data to say that, but it is much, much less. We do still have MPV vaccine available. So if you qualify, it is still the best thing to make sure that we don't see a rebound in transmission as people start to gather again. The basic recommendations are, if you qualify for PrEP, you probably qualify for MPV. You do qualify for the MPV vaccine, and there's a whole bunch of other folks who qualify for MPV. If you're wondering, if you're interested, give us a call at the health department. We have it. We can get you vaccinated.
Great. And I guess my final question is, you know, MPV being renamed to a less emotional name was, I think, an important step. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, how did the Kraken come about? Are we going to have the King Kong next? I mean, how did this, what's going on with all of a sudden emotionally like monster names?
Gosh, I don't know. And yeah, actually, technically, we in Washington State, we switched over to MPV earlier than the WHO did, because we really felt strongly about changing that name. So the WHO approved name is actually now Mpox. So slightly different than MPV, but similar idea. Same virus that you're talking about. Kraken appears to be exclusively media driven. It's not driven by public health or healthcare professionals. We don't recommend using that term, but it since people are probably seeing it in the media, it's good for you to know what we're talking about. But I do think it is important that we use data, we use reason, and we don't try to motivate folks with fear. It sells papers, but it doesn't actually help people make smart decisions.
Okay. Thank you for my wide range of questions. any other questions for Dr. Berry?
Not for me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Berry, for taking time out this week, and we'll see you the first Monday of February. Don't know when that
did
is.
To the KPDZ questions?
I think we did, didn't we?
Yeah,
did
just a few.
And I think those were actually created by staffers at KPDZ. We didn't actually have any listener questions this week. So. Yeah. So if you have questions, we'd love to have the good doctor address them. So do send them in.
Thank you. Have a great day, everybody.
Thanks. Have a great day. See you in February. See you at the Board of Health. Mm-hmm.